And the opinions and views expressed on Gaza Corner are those of mine, Dori Stein, and also my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KALW Public Media. We have a two-part Gaza Corner tonight. Part one will be a discussion with Andrea Assaf, the creator and director of 11 Reflections, which is premiering on the West Coast Friday and Saturday, October 4th and 5th, 7 p.m. at the Brava Theater Center in San Francisco. There's a link at the Gaza Corner section of the Tangents playlist. Part two of Gaza Corner will analyze Israel's mass casualty cyber terrorist attacks in Lebanon. But first, let me introduce Andrea Assaf, who is the artistic and executive director of Art to Action, which is a New York City, Tampa, Florida-based community arts organization. The website is art, the number two, so art2action.org. And Art to Action is producing a new iteration of 11 Reflections on the Nation called 11 Reflections San Francisco, in a local and national partnership with the Brava for Women in the Arts and the Golden Thread Productions. And these are three organizations committed to political work created with and for the community. Andrea Assaf is a writer, a performer, a director, a cultural organizer, and in addition to being the founding artistic and executive director of Art to Action, this is dear to my heart. She's also a poet and spoken word artist, and she combines poetry and activism. And she won the 2024 Joyce Award, the 2021 Silk Road Film Award at Cannes for Director of the Best Experimental Feature. And by complete tangential coincidence, she's an alum of NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, and so am I. So, Andrea, great.
Hello.
Great to have you here. Not really here. If you had to be here, you wouldn't be here. But we did it by Zoom, so you could be here. You have an intense schedule, and I'm so grateful that you made time for Gaza Corner tonight. So thank you so very much.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And it's an honor and a pleasure to be able to talk about Palestine on Gaza Corner. So thank you so much for inviting me.
So tell us about this, what truly is a unique creation, 11 Reflections, happening October 4th and 5th at Brava Theater Center.
It truly is unique in that it will happen, this version of the project will happen only here and only those two nights, October 4th and 5th in San Francisco. This whole series is city specific and created anew every time in every new city with community members who live in that city. And so even though there have been different iterations of the 11 Reflections project, the one you will see here is completely unique, created with actors and musicians and choreographers, various kinds of artists, even a visual artist who lives in the Bay Area participating alongside national and international guest artists who work with me on the overall national series. So we can talk about like some of the maybe unexpected things you might see in the project, but I'll give you a little background if that's helpful. 11 Reflections on September was the original production that I created as a spoken word piece. And like, shout out to NYU. I was glad that you mentioned that. I was a New Yorker in 2001 at the time that 9/11 happened, and a much younger emerging artist, and began writing a series of poems about being Arab American in the post, you know, through that experience of 9/11, 2001, and what I now think of as the post 9/11 era in the early 21st century. So I made this piece where I was like, what would happen if I take my very New York spoken word aesthetic and mix it with live music played by musicians and vocalists who specialize in Middle Eastern music. And that began the experiment. And I toured that show with myself as the solo writer slash voice speaker, not the only voice, but the speaker for years, really from 2011 to 2016 primarily. And then, as we all know, so much was happening in 2016. I started feeling like it wasn't enough for my voice to be the only perspective in the piece. There needed to be more Middle Eastern and voices and Muslim voices and people of all backgrounds who were affected in various ways by post 9/11 policies. And so I created this series, 11 Reflections on the Nation, where I go through partnerships with organizations, incredible organizations like Golden Thread and Brava, to partner and say, who's in your city and what stories do they have to tell? And how can we uplift and amplify those stories from this city, this community? And so that's what we're doing in San Francisco.
So you have at least 11 Bay Area artists and community members, and you also have two incredible musicians, and we'll get some music on in a bit. Tell me a bit about the community members and the musicians.
Sure. I have the great honor of being able to collaborate and tour with Lubana Alcantar, who is a vocalist. She is originally from Syria. She's a world-class opera singer, and she's also has an incredible repertoire of songs from Arab music, both classical and contemporary. And she's been working with this project with me since 2016. She's truly extraordinary. She is a treasure of the Middle East, and it's incredible to be able to work with her and to share this process and her voice with this community. And also, I'm bringing along my music director, Eylem Beşaldi, who is originally Turkish and plays violin, extraordinary violinist. And both of them have been working on the project. Actually, Eylem's been working on the project longer. She did the New York production with me in 2015 at La Mama. Yeah, Eylem leads the music ensemble, which will include Bay Area based musicians, Clarissa Bitar, who's an incredible oud player and is Palestinian. And Peter Mansour, who I'm going to get to work with for the first time, as well as several of the artists in the acting ensemble, who are all Bay Area actors and performers, who are co-writing this production with me, this San Francisco specific version. Many of them are singers and musicians as well, so you'll get to hear some of their original music, their original songs that they're creating specifically for this project. As well as some well-known Arab and Palestinian songs.
Would this be a good time to? You sent me a number of music selections that are actually part of previous productions, I believe.
Yes.
And the one Summer Rain combines both the vocals of Lubana with the violin work of Eylem Beşaldi. And I really like it a lot. So.
Great.
Why don't we get it on and
Yeah.
come on back and talk? This is Gaza Corner at 11 o'clock every Saturday night with our special guest, Andrea Assaf. And the production is October 4th and 5th, 7 p.m. at the Brava Theater Center. And this is KALW.org and 91.7. 91.7KALW.org. And this is Gaza Corner with Andrea Asaf. And that was just beautiful. That's incredible. There are so many reasons to attend this production. Just seeing, hearing that music just would make me go. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it truly is extraordinary to hear both of them live, and then to be joined by the exceptional local musicians who are also joining us. It's going to be a very special couple of nights, truly.
Yeah, I think some people, probably a lot of people, are not really familiar with the Golden Thread Productions. Mm. But it's really special. I don't know if it's the only at this point, you can tell me, or I know it was the first American theater company devoted to the Middle East. So what a collaboration. Perfect.
Yes, actually, you're correct. Golden Thread is the first and longest running theater dedicated to the Middle East in the United States. And now there are several wonderful and strong theaters around the country, such as Noor Theater in New York City and Silk Road Rising in Chicago and many others. And Golden Thread's leadership, both by example and actual like building leadership in the field across the country, continues with the being a founding member of the MENA Theater Makers Alliance, of which I am also a founding member. And we've actually actively been working together for several years now with a number of other theaters in that network to create the first national network for theater artists of Middle Eastern descent who identify as Middle Eastern American or from the Middle East themselves, to come together and, you know, create opportunities to share work and build a voice, really a cultural voice in the United States. So Golden Thread is an incredible treasure that you have right here in San Francisco. And also their leadership and partnership is truly wonderful.
The director, Sahara Asaf, same last name.
Yes, no relation. No relation as far as we know. Sahar is from Lebanon, and I am Lebanese-American, third generation. And we laugh a lot about the distant possibility that maybe we're cousins. But in fact, as far as we know, we are not related.
She had this wonderful quote that I'm going to read from the press release. It says, quote, "At Golden Thread, we are especially interested in theater that is political, responsive to the world around us, and created with and by the community, not just for it. Mm-hmm. This project embodies all those values. 11 Reflections, San Francisco, is the final production in our special season for Palestine, continuing our efforts to center Palestine while taking control of our narratives." And that is so important, mm-hmm. because for so long, it seems forever, Israel has been able to control the narrative because the mainstream media just echoes whatever it says. So it's important, so important to have your voices heard.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say that as far as I know, Golden Thread is the only theater company in the United States ever to declare a season for Palestine. And again, like I said, leadership by way of example, their commitment to, you know, not being afraid to speak out and creating spaces, supporting spaces for us to speak, it has been so profoundly important, especially in this time. Golden Thread and Art to Action have co-produced other projects, especially since October. One of which was a 24-hour live stream for Palestine, which you can still find. All of the sessions are archived, 24 hours of sessions with over 125 artists from around the world, including two theaters from Palestine, the Freedom Theater and Ashtar Theater, participating. And that all is archived on HowlRound Theater Commons, which is free and available online. If you just look at 24 Hours for Palestine, check it out, because the talk about creating a platform for voices to talk about Gaza and the ongoing genocide and what we can do, it's an extraordinary archive.
So you're suggesting if someone wants to find these 22 sessions, they would Google 24 hours for Palestine. I think they can also add a moon will rise from darkness.
Correct.
So 24 hours for Palestine, a moon will rise from darkness, and they will find it. Again, the show is October. The shows are October 4th and 5th, 7 p.m. at the Brava Theater Center. That's right in the Mission, 2781 24th Street. And what's cool is that it's a sliding scale from $25 to $100, but also no one will be turned away for lack of funds, which is, I think, very, very important.
Yeah.
It's
We want this show, we want everyone who is willing to come and listen, to hear this piece. We in the context of Golden Threads season for Palestine, and what's happening right now, this piece has evolved to be not only about the post 9/11 era in the United States, but how we got here, how we got from 9/11 to the US actively funding and supporting an actual genocide of Arab people, specifically Palestinian people. I think those two things are very related. And the show, in a way, is an exploration of how we understand that. And it's an exploration through stories and poetry and songs and the lived experiences of not only Arab American participants and Palestinian participants, also Jewish American allies, and those of us who have complex and hybrid identities. And so we hope that what you'll come hear is a really nuanced and truthful and daring examination of our role in the genocide that's currently happening.
I imagine you go to different cities, and in fact, you'll be going to New York City in 2026 to culminate the
Yes.
series, the 25th anniversary of 9/11. So every city, it will be really a different production, similar theme, but very different, and
Yes.
obviously using local people at every city. But in San Francisco, since it is part of Golden Threads' season of Palestine, how have you kind of, shaped it to be more about Palestine? And how when these stories are being told by the people, is it all kind of scripted out, and or is there a lot of improvisation? How does that play out?
Yes, all of the above. In fact, I just finished the second complete draft of the script yesterday. The cast read it for the first time yesterday, because we have been creating it together through a process that I devise a structure and guide the ensemble through a process that includes storytelling, as in sh sharing real personal life experiences. It includes writing monologues and poetry and songs together. It includes a lot of improvisation. And I've really, really enjoyed working with Deborah Eliezer, who is also a founding board member of the MENA Theater Makers Alliance and currently with Aviva Arts, which is a collaborating partner on this project as well. Deborah is an incredible facilitator of ensemble process, and we've had a great time kind of passing the baton in the rehearsals and sharing leadership and collaborating. So yeah, a lot of improvisation. And in fact, we just spent the entire day today in the studio with choreographer Pearl Ubungan, who is a San Francisco choreographer whose work I have followed and admired for probably more than 20 years. And we've always wanted an opportunity to work together. And we spent the entire day in improvisation, in movement improvisation led by Pearl. Today and tomorrow, we're going to go out to, I'm not going to reveal it. We're going to go out to a special location in San Francisco and film the choreographic structures that we were exploring today outside in the San Francisco Bay Area. And that film will become part of the performance and the production that you'll see on October 4th and 5th as well. So it's very much being created right now. It's evolving every day.
That's amazing. It's like an endless creation. It's just, I mean, and what's beautiful, one of the things that I really, as a music lover, I never like going to a concert by an artist, and I think the artist kills it, and then I have to see this artist again. That was so good. And they crack the same joke at the same time, and every song is the same. I'm going, what the hell? And this is 180 degrees from that. This is, and I'm sure the show on October 5th will be quite different from the show on October 4th. I mean, that's fair to say, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think structure is important, and we do have to have things that are repeatable. But there also will be moments of improvisation, and certainly, I think, moments of discovery. And I always feel as a performer that the audience is very much part of the event, and it's my job to make space for the energy that they bring into the room and how I respond to it, and that it should be it should be dialogic, right? So in that sense, it's never the same because we should be listening to each other even in the moment of performance.
No, that's well said. That's really well said. We should give a shout out to, I mean, this can't happen without, without funding, and you definitely have funders, and you want to just mention who they are?
Well, actually, I will say Golden Thread, has a list of supporters and funders that support their work and are supporting their Season for Palestine, and especially also individual donors who are supporting the Season for Palestine. And I'd actually have to pull up the list. But in addition to that, I'll give a shout out to one of Art to Action's supporters currently, which is the Ford Foundation. I have to say that funding this work, I've spent really ever since 9/11 doing a lot of work about war and about US military policy and funding and what we do with it and what we're responsible for. And I have to say that getting it funded is very, very hard, and it always has been. But I think, and this brings me to talking about what's happening in Palestine right now and what I hope will be very present in the show and for the audience when you come, is that we are in a moment of sea change. We are in a moment that I've never seen before in my lifetime in terms of public support for Palestine. And I'm old enough to remember the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and the BDS movement to end apartheid in South Africa. And I remember that there was a sea change moment. I remember there was a moment when the US was an ally of South Africa. And there was a moment when we could no longer be because public opinion had changed, right? And I really believe we're in one of those moments now, as horrific and horrible as this is, as the genocide is. And I want to name also the current bombings in Lebanon. And the way this is expanding, and the very dangerous moment we're in of how it could all escalate. At the same time, people are saying no. People are at finding ways to support this kind of work and to show up for each other and to show up for it. And I think it's just really important that we know that we're in a historic moment and that it can change.
Well, governments lag behind the street. It's just
Always.
it's always that way, but certainly there is the groundswell of a shift in opinion, and it will at some point matter. But in the United States, we have two presidential candidates who so far have not shown any inclination to listen to those voices. In fact, as you know, Harris didn't even allow a Palestinian American to speak at the DNC. So it's hard. I have part of me optimistic like you, and another part is not. But I think in time, liberation in Palestine has to happen. But
Yeah, absolutely.
who knows, when that is. I do want to add, I have some notes that the Zellerbach Family Foundation, the Walter and Elise Haas Foundation, and for me, most importantly, the Sam Mazza Foundation, because I'm dear friends with Jeanette Kuhl, and she is so generous. She's on the board of the Sam Mazza Foundation, and she just always puts her heart and foundation money at the right places. And she has, in part, provided, I think, important support for 11 Reflections, San Francisco.
Thank you for naming that.
So I'll say good night. I know you have an early call. The show is our October 4th and 5th, 7 p.m. at the Brava Theater Center in the heart of the Mission, 2781 24th Street. There's a link at the Gaza Corner section of the Tangents playlist, and go ahead and click it and learn more about this truly creative and unique production that's so timely and so important. So thank you, Andrea. I really appreciate you accommodating this late hour and sharing your views and this important work on Gaza Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, good night. We will now move to part two of Gaza Corner. And I will make the assumption that everyone listening knows about the two consecutive days, Tuesday and Wednesday of this past week, of indiscriminate cyber carnage in Lebanon. Did you see the headline, Israel's New Campaign of Terrorism Warfare Across Lebanon? Did you see that headline? I doubt it. I doubt you saw that headline, Israel's New Campaign of Terrorism Warfare Across Lebanon. I mean, nowhere in Western mainstream media, and I did a pretty exhaustive search, was the word terrorism in any headline I could find in the New York Times, NPR, Washington Post, BBC, and so forth. The best NPR could do was this one from yesterday. Did exploding pagers attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon violate international law? Question mark. I'll give you a hint. The answer is yes, and more on that in a bit. The closest the New York Times came was, quote, a new era in sabotage, turning ordinary devices into grenades on a mass scale. But it seems an enemy of the United States, Hezbollah, being a victim of a terrorist attack, that cannot be in a headline. Israel's new campaign of terrorism warfare across Lebanon was the proper headline. And it came from The Intercept, which is not a mainstream news outlet but does excellent investigative work. The mainstream Western media seemed astonished at the so-called precision and sophistication of the attack, initially swallowing and maybe still swallowing Israeli propaganda, framing it as an operation intended only to target members of Hezbollah. But the 2 days of cyber terrorism were anything but precise. Precision, I don't know how in the world that word got into any of the mainstream media. It was intentionally indiscriminate. And what if the shoe was on the other foot? Can you imagine the headlines? Imagine, if you will, all over Israel, if communication devices blew limbs apart, killed close to 40 people, injured over 3,250 people, which was the case in Lebanon over those 2 days. I can tell you that the very same mainstream media outlets would have plastered their front pages with headlines decrying what they would describe as one of the most barbaric cyber terrorist attacks in modern history. Iran would have eventually been blamed, and the U.S. Congress would be frothing at the mouth to go to war with Iran. But Israel does not adhere to international humanitarian law. The rules of war are irrelevant when it comes to Israel. What happened this past week are the actions of a rogue state. It's what happens when a country knows there are no consequences to committing war crimes, violating international humanitarian law, or for that matter, committing genocide, even if the ICC at this point calls it plausible. I think eventually it will be just genocide. And they can act this way as a direct result of a climate of total impunity, even dating back to Zionist terrorist militias before the creation of Israel. Per the Washington Post, says U.S. officials acknowledged that Israel was behind the attack, as if there was any doubt. Two U.S. officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the Israelis did not inform the United States about the specifics before the attack took place, but told Washington afterward through intelligence channels. You might be wondering why Hezbollah was using beepers to begin with, which essentially have been outdated for a couple of decades. Quoting from the New York Times, an article linked at the Gaza Corner section, a good piece of investigative journalism, How Israel Built a Modern-Day Trojan Horse, Exploding Pagers. Quote, in Lebanon, as Israel picked off senior Hezbollah commandos with targeted assassinations, their leader, Nasrallah, came to a conclusion. If Israel was going high tech, Hezbollah would go low. It was clear, Hassan Nasrallah said, that Israel was using cell phone networks to pinpoint the locations of his operatives. So despite the limited capabilities of beepers, beepers can receive data without giving away a user's location or other compromising information. The New York Times investigative piece asserts that even before Nasrallah decided to expand pager usage, Israel had already put in motion a plan to establish a shell company that would pose as an international pager producer. Quoting again from that New York Times article, BAC Consulting was a Hungary-based company that was under contract to produce the devices on behalf of a Taiwanese company. The Taiwanese company is called Gold Apollo. In fact, it was part of an Israeli front, according to three intelligence officers briefed on the operation. They said at least two other shell companies were created as well to mask the real identities of the people creating the pagers, who were Israeli intelligence officers. According to the president of Gold Apollo, Su Xing Huang, payments to Gold Apollo from BAC reportedly came from a bank account registered to an unnamed country in the Middle East, causing occasional delays and freezes in payment. And despite BAC being based in Hungary, the president of Gold Apollo called the arrangement, quote unquote, strange. Reporters from the Associated Press who visited the building in Hungary, listed as the headquarters of BAC, which is in a residential neighborhood of Budapest, found a building used as a site for headquarter addresses of multiple companies. The Mossad, the Israeli Mossad, controlled the supply chain and inserted a few ounces of the explosive PETN concealed within the devices. They were actually laced into the batteries. This according to three intelligence officers in the New York Times piece. Israel triggered the pagers to beep and sent a message to them in Arabic that appeared as though it had come from Hezbollah's senior leadership. A security analyst and journalist in Lebanon by the name of Ali Jazini, who has been speaking to hospital workers treating the wounded, said, quote, "It did give a code, and it continued to ring and vibrate. So that's why they had to hold it in their hands to check what's happening. It was faulty. It was not responding. So that's why they kept it in front of their faces and the palms of their hands, because they're trying to figure out what's wrong with it. That's why most of the injuries are like that. It didn't explode right away." And that's from Jeremy Scahill and his new site called DropSite. Among those killed in the attacks, children, medics, other civilians, as the explosions occurred in supermarkets, houses, hospitals, schools, crowded streets. This is why I say it was indiscriminate and not precise. Hezbollah is a huge grassroots organization. It's not just a militia. So people who work in its civil institutions were killed and injured. And of at least 37 dead, four were children, one of whom was Fatima Abdullah. She lived in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley. She had just come home from her first day of fourth grade when she heard her father's pager begin to beep. She picked up the beeper, brought it to him, and was holding it when it exploded, killing her. Fatima was 9 years old. This story is in that New York Times piece. How would you conduct your life if common, everyday communication devices had become instruments of death? This is the collective psychological trauma the Lebanese are going through right now. This is not only terrorism by indiscriminate death and injury, but psychological terrorism. Because the devices in question began beeping repeatedly before they exploded, many victims were holding them close to their faces when they detonated, causing horrifying injuries. On Democracy Now! On September 19th, Amy Goodman interviewed a doctor, Dr. Dania El Halak, and she spoke about the injuries. And the very beginning of her audio is a little hard to hear. She says, "We saw young victims and we saw old victims.
We saw young victims and we saw very old victims. And all just had the same type of wounds. They had puncture wounds on their faces. They had amputated limbs. They had open abdomens, intestines out, bowels out. Unfortunately, there were wounds that you couldn't explain. There were ruptured eyeballs. There were fractured mandibles, fractured bones out. So basically, it was the first time I ever see wounds like that. I couldn't even classify some wounds or categorize some wounds."
That is Dr. Dania El Halak from Democracy Now! On September 19th. The day before, on September 18th, Democracy Now! Had Mohammed Clayet, a Beirut-based journalist. And he said, quote, "These pagers are used by Hezbollah, basically by the people who are medics, who work in logistics, not the people who work, very few of them, who work in the military sector of Hezbollah use these pagers." And Amal Said, a leading expert on Hezbollah, said, quote, everyone's scared to send text messages, to make calls. They're afraid to open laptops. It's definitely led to some level of complete disorientation, fear, confusion, paranoia. It has huge psychological effects. People have started to say, okay, this is going to be the new type of warfare. This is going to be how they're going to fight. It's going to be terrorism warfare. So this is the new normal now. I'm starting to realize the objective behind this was to terrorize and paralyze and demoralize. Lama Fakia, the Middle East and North Africa director at Human Rights Watch, said in a statement, quote, customary international humanitarian law prohibits the use of booby traps, objects that civilians are likely to be attracted to or are associated with normal civilian daily use, precisely to avoid putting civilians at grave risk and produce the devastating scenes that continue to unfold across Lebanon. The Irish foreign minister, Michael Martin, called a quote-unquote wanton disregard for civilian life not a discriminating operation. Israel is justifying, well, they justify everything they do in the name of self-defense, of course, and they're justifying this with a particular goal, justifying the mass casualty cyber attacks as a way to return some 70,000 Israelis who have been displaced from their homes in the north of the country. At the same time, Israeli bombing attacks have displaced more than 113,000 people from southern Lebanon. This is according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Israel, as I say, always has a reason, and it's usually a smokescreen. Now, don't get me wrong. They'd like to have the 70,000 people get back in their homes. But I don't think that's the primary reason this was done. And there is no way Hezbollah will agree to calm the waters unless a permanent ceasefire is in place in Gaza. As mentioned earlier, Israel's real objective was to ignite mass panic and fear among an entire population. No one knows what will come next. The odds of a full-blown regional war certainly has increased. I've said for many months, in my opinion, and I've said this on Gaza Corner repeatedly, that Prime Minister Netanyahu believes he would solidify his power, his hold as prime minister, if there's no ceasefire agreement, which he's derailed at every turn, sabotaged the ceasefire talks the entire time, insisting on impossible-to-meet conditions so he can extend the genocide in Gaza for as long as possible. In that way, he doesn't have to face peace. Peace would bring him down. His coalition would fall apart. He would be facing his corruption charges. But Netanyahu, I believe, will risk all-out regional war to solidify his hold on power. I believe Netanyahu would want Iran to enter directly, and probably believes, and he may be right, I don't know, the U.S. would have no choice but to put boots on the ground to save Israel. This scenario would help Netanyahu in another way. A war in the Middle East involving the United States would weaken Biden-Harris, depending when it happens. Obviously, Netanyahu would want it to happen before the election, so it would weaken Harris and provide a boost to Trump's election chances. Netanyahu has played Biden like a fiddle, especially with these ceasefire talks. But he and Harris apparently don't have a comfortable relationship. Trump followed Netanyahu's directives to a T when he was president, and Netanyahu believes that would be the case again. A full-blown war in the Middle East would be devastating for all involved, especially for Lebanon, which is already on its knees economically. It's practically a failed state. and still traumatized from the deadly 2020 explosion in its port. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, said, quote, "This tragic situation cannot be seen in isolation," talking about the cyber terrorist attacks. According to Türk, it is, quote, "bound up with the war in Gaza, the spiraling violence in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian territory." A panel of UN human rights experts said in a statement on Thursday, September 19th, quote, "A climate of fear now pervades everyday life in Lebanon. These attacks violate the human right to life. Absent any indication that the victims posed an imminent lethal threat to anyone else at the time," the statement continued, calling for a prompt, independent investigation. There's always been an obvious solution: getting a permanent ceasefire done in Gaza. That would calm the region down. But that is now being reported that even Joe Biden, ever the optimist, has said in a Wall Street Journal piece that he does not believe a ceasefire will be accomplished before the election.